Thank you for your introduction. It sort of leads me to tell you that I really feel very privileged and really quite thrilled to be here. First of all, I'm privileged to be alive. I think that any survivor who survived was a miracle. And when I think of my own survival, there's just no way I could be here. When I tell you my story, yesterday I spoke to somebody and they said, what you're saying is it that you remembered or that you heard or that you really did. Well, many of the things that I say, I remembered, but I needed proof. First thing, I needed proof that I was born. I have two different birthdays. One that really I found in 1989 first. And I had six different names. I had six different mothers. I was a boy. I was a girl. I didn't know exactly who I am. When I came here today and I saw all these people and I recognized some of them, and my friend Lynn, who's like a sister, came to hear me. I don't know how many times she's heard me. And David, we were together in 1992 on the March of the Living with his wife, and I remember some of the programs that we had done there. And it's true that I think they said that 15 survivors every month die. Of course, other people also, but most survivors are in their 80s and 90s, so it's a natural kind of thing. I don't have to describe all of these different things. But I thought today that I have one request of yours. It's a very busy time. But when I hear about all these people dying and all these different things are going on, there's a new program. I don't know if you heard about this. I just heard about it this morning on Channel 10 on Orlie and Guy. They're having programs for third generation. How many of you are third generation? Okay, only one?
What's third generation?
It's your grandparents.
Yeah.
In other words, the second generation would be your parents, and the third generation. Now, I know her grandmother, I know both her grandparents. Yaffa Eliak was a very, very famous person. She has a whole big exhibit in the museum. She wrote a book called The Shtetl. Her father was the principal of the Yeshiva Flatbush, and my husband was the chairman of the Board of Education. And I must tell you that the Yeshiva of Flatbush rejected me. And they were absolutely right. When I came to the United States, I think it's absolutely amazing that I'm speaking to you, a group of people who are going to be educators, who are going to be leaders, young Jewish people who have come to be part of the Jewish people, part of Jewish society, and I'm speaking to you in English. I didn't speak a word of English until I was 10 years old. I didn't know how to read. I didn't know how to write. I didn't know arithmetic. I knew nothing. They didn't have a school in Bergen-Belsen. So when I came, and my adopted parents who spoke to me in English and who were very well read tried to enroll me in Yeshiva Flatbush, they said, no, she wouldn't fit in. If she doesn't speak English and she doesn't speak Hebrew and science and math is something she never heard of, the Yeshiva of Crown Heights refused me. Brooklyn Jewish Center, which was a small day school, accepted me, and with tutoring, I learned to speak English. And now, English is my mother tongue, which is really quite amazing. So what is my request to you? Thank God I have grandchildren. I have 22 grandchildren and 17 great-grandchildren. They're all Hebrew speakers. Nevertheless, what they're trying to do now is to get the third generation. So if all of you aren't part of the third generation, I would like to adopt you, and I would like to be the grandmother, so all of you can come to visit me whenever you want. You can do laundry in my house, you can do whatever you want, but you have to take on the task of repeating the stories of survivors so it's not lost, so it goes on, because I think it's very important, and as David said, in a few years there won't be anybody who will be able to get up and speak. So now I'm going to tell you my own personal story. If you have any questions, if I'm not making myself clear, don't hesitate. I don't have a whole book of... What happened to my book? I have a book of pictures, but she might be able to show it to you on time. Otherwise, I will show you some of them. My story is different from most survivor stories because 1.5 million children perished. And if you've been in the Children's Memorial and you've heard about it, you know 1.5 million children perished. They were murdered because they were Jewish children. I'm different because I stayed alive. A great-grandmother's not supposed to have iPhones, right? If she does, I'm sorry. That's my daughter. I'll call you back.
That's the equivalent of chew or upshot. I just tell them I'm in Syria.
Okay, I forgot, but I turned it off. Okay, I mean, this happens all the time, but I turned it off, and luckily you see who called you, so I want to tell you that my granddaughter, who's studying in Harvard, sent me a picture that she got on
Instagram.
I know how to use YouTube, and I know how to use
Instagram.
I don't know how to use Instagram. And I didn't know how to do it, so she found it. And what it said, it had a picture of a great-grandmother using an iPhone in Yad Vashem. And, you know, people don't expect you to be able to use that, but we're living in a modern world. Anyway, I had said to you that I was different because I was alive. Second of all, my story is different because most children who did survive were in hiding, were on false papers, were in convents, in certainly not many children went through the camps. They were too young, they were too inexperienced, they were too weak. And if they weren't going to be able to work, they were killed right away. I went through the ghetto. I went through various concentration camps. I was liberated from Bergen-Belsen. And if you know your history, Bergen-Belsen was one of the worst, one of the bad. I don't know what is worse. And it's very well documented because the British came in and took a lot of pictures. There was a new movie that just came out on YouTube, by the way, that Alfred Hitchcock took that they didn't think was appropriate to show because it was so horrifying. And so he waited, and now they decided that it can be shown. So I went through the various camps. My story is different because when you lose your mother and your father and your brothers and the rest of the family, they're gone forever. Every time I lost a mother, somebody came along and I was attached to her. And when that mother was not there, I had another mother. And when that mother wasn't there, I wound up with six different mothers, and I thought that it was normal. That every time somebody's taken away, somebody else is there. And I was lucky, because between the ages of 3 1/2 and 9 1/2, I don't think a child could possibly survive alone. It wasn't like a mother that gave you a birthday party or tucked you in at night or did something like that, but the fact that I had somebody. And very often you hear survivors saying that everybody had to be out for themselves. I can tell you that I always had help. And then my story is different because it has a happy ending. After the war, I was brought from Sweden. I was adopted in Sweden, brought to America. And after that, I was adopted by an American Jewish Zionistic religious family who treated me like an American princess. I had music lessons, I had art lessons, I went to camp, I had a Sweet 16, I had a big wedding, and I had all the different things. And my children are different than other survivors' children, because most survivors don't have grandparents. Most survivors' children don't have a family. I did. They weren't my biological family. Nobody in my biological family remained alive, but my adopted family did give me aunts and uncles and cousins. So in that way, it's different. I was born in a city called Pietrakov, and you might know the name because Rabbi Lau was the rabbi in Pietrakov. And before that was Rabbi Meir Shapiro. You may know his name because he started Chachmei Lublin. Nice to see you shaking. And he also started Daf Yomi. So, and he married my parents. And I have his signature, which my grandchildren think is really cool to have the signature of Rabbi Meir Shapiro. Pietrakov had the distinction of being the first ghetto that was established when the Nazis came into Poland in September of 1939. We lived in the Jewish section. We, meaning my mother, my father. What did I do with the book? I went for it and didn't get it. Later on, you'll see these pictures. But I just want to tell you, when I went back to 1989, I took these pictures. This was the house we lived in. And there's a mezuzah still on the door. And the Polish woman let us in. We'll see those pictures afterwards. When they decided to make the ghetto, they fenced in, they walled in the area where most Jews lived. Any Jews who did not belong, they were taken out. They had plenty of other places to go in because Jews living in surrounding areas were not allowed to stay there, and they had to move into the ghetto. And then people in surrounding towns and villages who didn't have a ghetto were brought into Pietrakov ghetto. So if you think of any of your homes, no matter how big and spacious they are, if you have 4 and 5 and 6 families moving in, and there isn't enough food, and there isn't enough heat, and Poland is very cold all the time, and there isn't enough medicine, and people get sick, there was a big typhus epidemic, you can imagine things were bad. People were dying of starvation and of different kinds of sicknesses, but they weren't dying fast enough. So Hitler and his henchmen decided to do something about it. First they took the able-bodied people like my father and other strong or young people. I guess all of you probably would have fit into that category. And they took them to slave labor factories. My father was taken to a glass factory, not far away, and they lived over there.
How old were you then?
Well, when the war started, I was 3 and a half. This may have been when I was 5, 5 and a half, 6. I don't know. I really don't have the exact dates of any of these things. When people ask me what I remember smells very well. I remember the cold going through you. I remember the fear of dogs and things of that sort. I don't remember dates. However, I do have a lot of new documents that prove the things that I'm saying. But exactly, it was the war years for me were between 3 and a half and 9 and a half. So let's say I was close to 5 and a half or 6. They decided to have an action, a raza, where in the middle of the night and toward early morning, they came banging down at the doors with guns, with revolvers, with whips, with anything that you can imagine. You know, rouse, rouse, everybody, schnell, schnell. You have 5 minutes to get out and run in. And there was a big square, all the houses. How many of you have been to Poland? So you know what I'm talking about, all the different squares that were that are there. So we were brought into this big square. We had to run down the steps. First of all, what would you take if you had 5, 10 minutes, 15 minutes? What would you take from your house if you were being taken out? Some people say they would take pictures. Some people say they would take money. They would take silver. They would take food. They would take blankets. Maybe instead of the pictures, you want to take the baby or your old grandmother. It's not an easy choice to take. When you think of a tsunami or you think of an earthquake, what do you grab first? Well, here, people started taking whatever they could and running down the stairs. And if somebody fell, other people fell on top of them. There was pandemonium. There was chaos. This is the house, and I know exactly. I found the address, and I took a picture of that. And by the way, the only good things that I remember before the war was that across the street from this house, there was a kiosk that I could get ice cream. And down the block from that house, there's a bakery. And every Friday, my mother would make a big pot of meat and potatoes, beans and barley, and my two brothers, David and Jesse, would pull me on a sled. Somehow there seems to me that I remember snow all the time, to the bakery. It would bake all night, and the next day, with that wonderful smell, they would take it back. Most people didn't have stove, so the bakery was the place to make chocolate. That's the only nice thing that I remember about that house. But the woman there did let me in to see it. We were brought into this big square, and then we were whipped and herded through the streets like a herd of animals until we got to the synagogue. The synagogue is now a library. You have the picture of that? If you don't, okay, so it doesn't matter. And inside, there's a big room. Maybe it's the size of this room. That would probably be the size of the room. And there were 2,000 people who had been gathered together. As many as they could, they got in. This is the woman who lives in the house. This is the stairs that we had to run down. Can I move? Okay. And I took the parquet floor because it was a nice apartment. I mean, you know, well, I'll tell you about my mother afterwards, but it was a nice apartment. Anyway, we were chased through the streets, and we were brought into the synagogue. The synagogue is still standing. You can go and get books there now. Here is the synagogue, and you can see the Mug and Dovet out there. And you can see I hired a guide because I didn't speak any, I don't speak Polish. I don't know if I ever spoke Polish. In the camps, the common language was Yiddish. So if you have people coming from France and Germany and Poland and Hungary, the common language was Yiddish. And when I came to America, that's what I spoke, some Yiddish, a little bit of Swedish, because I went to Sweden after the war. We were brought into this big room. There was crying. Nobody knew exactly what to do. There was tohu vavohu, real confusion, real commotion. I don't know how it was possible. There was shooting going on there. And when you get to see the next picture, you will see, you can see the Aron Kodesh. Can you see? Am I in the way? The Aron Kodesh with all the bullet holes there. And you can imagine what was going on. Now, I, as a little girl, maybe close to 6, I don't know exactly. I'm sure, what do little girls do? I'm sure I must have been holding on to my mother. I'm just as sure that my mother must have been holding on to me and to my brothers, who are just 1.5 and 2.5 years older. And I know that for a fact now, not that I remember that, but I found their birth certificates. So I know, and I found my own birth certificate. I don't know how this possibly could have happened. On the other side of the door there, there was a man whom I called uncle. I don't know if he was a real uncle or was the polite way of addressing an older person. But there he was. My name at that time was Fredja, or Fredel in Yiddish. And he said, run. He beckoned me and he said, run. I must have been very stupid, very naive. Maybe my mother pushed me. Maybe God pushed me. I ran. I let go of my mother's hand and I ran. The soldiers there could have easily shot me. You can see all the bullet holes. Could have bopped me over the head. Could have pushed me back. Either they didn't see me because there was such confusion and pandemonium. Or else they figured, how far is this kid going to run? Let the next person shoot her. Let the next soldier take care of it. I can't explain to you how it possibly could have happened. But I ran out. I ran out of that door. There were 2,000 people. Many of them were brought into that room. The others were brought into a room upstairs, like a meeting room or something like that. And the rest were taken out into the forest. And they had to dig ditches, and they were shot. And the people in that room, like my mother and my brothers and the rest of the family and neighbors, were all put on the trains and taken to Treblinka. And I very often think about, what was my mother's last thoughts on this world? Was she worried about the boy she was taken to an unknown destination, which may have been death? Or was she concerned about the little girl whom she let go, who was certainly not able to take care of herself, and she didn't know what would happen over there? And I hope she's looking up, looking down from heaven someplace to look to see that her daughter did survive, and her daughter did. She has a progeny of 43 people who were my children, grandchildren, my children who were married, all that. And I hope she can see that the Jewish people are alive. But I can imagine those last few hours being taken by train to Treblinka. And now, when you go to Treblinka, and many of you have been there, there's 17,000 stones. Nobody's buried under those stones. One of them is the stone of Pietrica, which is my stone. And maybe later I'll tell you how I found it. And here this is Pietrica. And before that, you saw the pictures of the synagogue. And that's me with one of the March of the Living groups, or one of the groups, I don't remember which one. 840,000 people were killed in Treblinka, including my mother and brothers and the people in Pietrakov, including Rabbi Lau, by the way. None of them survived. This man, who was my uncle, took me to my father. What was my father supposed to do? He was working in a factory, which was a glass factory for men. There were two other factories in the place. One was woodworking, one was tanning of leather, which had men and women. But this one was men. So for a while, he hid me. When that was no longer possible, he changed my name to Froim, which was the masculine. He said that I was 10 years old, because boys under 10 were useless, but over 10, maybe you could work. He cut my hair. I learned to speak the grammar of a male. I became a man of 10. How I did it, I don't know. But somehow or other, when you have to do things, you manage. I'm not that tall. I'm not that masculine. I became a man. And my job was delivering pails of water for the men to drink. I don't think the Germans really cared about people being thirsty. But if you would faint from not drinking, you wouldn't work. And they wanted this manpower. They wanted working. So my job was delivering work. It was hard work. How I did it, I don't know. More than anything, what we were afraid of was dogs. There were Latvian and Lithuanian and German guards. And they had big German shepherd dogs. And they were on a leash. But any time they wanted to show you who'd be in charge, they'd stick one of those dogs on a group. Just imagine a group like this, a dog coming in and running to you. And whoever would be the unfortunate person to be caught by that, it was like a death sentence. If your arm hurt so much that you couldn't lift it up, if you weren't working, you were killed. If you got infected, if you didn't have bandages, you would die. The fear of those dogs never leaves you. And there they were all the time, in our factory and throughout the camps and in the ghettos. Those dogs were always there. They were vicious. They were trained to kill and to maim. I remember one day that I got up and I thought the worst thing happened to me because I had pimples all over. Probably you had the exact same thing. It was either chickenpox or measles that normal children have. And even if we were in camps, it was spring and it was normal, I had it. And I remember how lucky I felt when they went away and how lucky I feel now that I wasn't completely pockmarked, being in a place with soot and no water and no medicine and nobody to say drink or wash or whatever you do when you have these different things. As I said, I think everything that happened was sort of miraculous. As hard as we worked, as much as we produced, one day the Germans decided they no longer wanted any Jews in the town of Pietrakov. It was going to be Judenrein. And again, there was a raza, an action, and we were taken to the Umschlagplatz, which is the place where the cattle cars would come in. And we were marched into that place. And the cattle cars, I don't know if you have, yes, we have a picture. When animals use these cars, they have steps or ramps. We didn't even have that. Everybody had to push everybody else in. And people wanted to get in there. But things were so bad, they couldn't get any worse. Well, they did. Nobody knew what to expect. We were pushed into these cars. And for 3 days and three nights, we were on these cars. You see, everybody's pushing. 80 to 100 people were in those cars. Nothing to eat, nothing to drink, and there was one toilet. What is the toilet? It consisted of a pail. This whole group, or maybe more than this group, would use that pail. Men, women, children. People were collected from three factories, the glass factory, the woodworking, and the tanning. On these trains, you had to use it. You couldn't even get over there. And you imagine the stench. Thing warmed over. Even if you don't eat, you have to go to the bathroom. I don't know how anybody was able to breathe. The only openings that you'd have on top there, and icicles would form because it was so cold, but inside, the heat of people's breathing and just body heat and people dying, and that toilet that was there. How people survived that, I don't know. We were on those trains for about 3 days. Shouldn't have taken that long. Actually, we were leaving Poland to go to Germany. Now, that sounds strange. How many extermination camps were there? Six. Auschwitz-Birkenau, Majdanek, Treblinka, Sobibor, Belzec, Chełmno. Where were they all? In Poland. Why were they all in Poland?
To be hidden there.
Huh?
Could be hidden. They were not known.
Nobody knew about them. Also, most of the Jews they wanted to kill came from Poland. So that was there. All the tracks, you've seen the tracks going into, led into the camps. And the Polish people at that time were the kind that 5,000 people came in on these trains. Empty trains left. 5,000 people came in next day. Empty trains left. Where did all these people sleep? Where did they eat? Where did they work? What did they do? Nobody asked. Nobody cared. And you know in Majdanek, if you're in Majdanek, 5 minutes away, you're in Lublin. And you can smell it and you can see it. In Auschwitz and in Auschwitz, the camps were near places that people, if they wanted to ask, could ask. Nobody asked. But when the war was coming to an end, when the Allies were coming closer, especially the Russians, the Germans decided to hide what they had done. And they started, they exhumed all the I should have told you that when my mother and brothers were taken to Treblinka, they were sent right into the gas chambers, and then their bodies burned on open pits because they didn't have enough crematorium. Later on, in Auschwitz, they could kill 5,000 people a day. But in Treblinka first, so they assumed those graves, they burned the bodies and threw out all the ashes. Someone like Anne Frank was taken from Auschwitz to Bergen-Belsen, where she died before liberation. So people were being transferred. So here we were being transferred from Poland to Germany. When we crossed the border, the doors were flung open, and we had to jump out of these cars. And it was snowing. It was always snowing. It was always cold. And I know that's not true, because in 6 years, there must have been in spring and summer. But there was snow on the ground, and we used the snow to eat it. And we used the snow to drink it. And we used the light to look around to see who was still there, because it's pitch black in those things. I'll show you afterwards. These are the kind of beds, if you were lucky to get in Bergen-Belsen, but we'll talk about it afterwards. Excuse me. We were in that snow. We were getting used to this new situation, and we saw that there were people who had come from the other camps. And while we were getting from the other factories, while we were getting used to this new situation, Germans, clean and neat, black boots, came on motorcycles with sidecars, and they made announcements on bullhorns that we were being taken to camps, men on one side, women on the other. My father realized, excuse me, I'm sorry. When you go into a camp, what do you have to do? You have to go into disinfection. Why? Well, first of all, we were filthy. We were covered with feces. We were covered with dirt we hadn't washed. And there were all kinds of lice and fleas and things around us. The Germans were clean. They didn't want people like that. That was one reason. But the Germans were clever about everything they did. Another reason for disinfection is if I take off everything I have, I can't hide anything. If I have a ring and you have a necklace and a watch, maybe you could hide it in a false hand. If you're naked, there's no place to hide anything. So they could confiscate everything that you own, and they could give you an old uniform or an old rag. My father realized that if I go in and if I get undressed, what would happen? They would see I'm not one of the men. They would kill me. That would kill my father and anybody else who dared harbor me, who dared try to help me. He realized that couldn't happen. He met a school teacher who had come from one of the other factories, and he asked her if she would keep an eye on me. And he gave me some pictures. And he said to look at those pictures and keep them all the time. My mother and my father and my brothers, and we had a good time and everything was fine. And right after the war, he will meet me in our hometown in Pietrzykow, and everything will continue just fine. And keep the pictures, look at the pictures, and, you know, everything will be fine. He promised to meet me. He never kept his promise. Sorry. He was sent to Buchenwald, and the women were sent to Bergen-Belsen. I never saw him again. However, Rabbi Lau and Naftali Levi, who were there, were on the same train, and other people who did survive Buchenwald. I don't know if he died on the train, if... All I know is that he had to sign in to Buchenwald, so I found those papers. You know, like you sign in when you go into a hospital or something like that, and what he owned. He didn't own anything, but he had three children and a wife. So at least it proved that he existed and he had a family. The men left. We were taken on... We went on one of these death marches. Snowing. It's always snowing. We were high up on the mountain, and down below, in the ravine, in the valley, there were two men lying in that freezing cold snow with their pants down. Why would you have two men lying in that valley with their pants down? Anybody have any idea?
To see if they're circumcised.
Exactly. If a Jewish woman ran away, not all of you look typically Jewish. Maybe you could get away pretending that you're a Christian. If a Jewish man ran away and he was circumcised in those years, only the Jewish people were circumcised, the Jewish men. It was a definite sign. There they were with their pants down. You think you're going to fool us? We know who's a Jew, and you're not going to get away with any of this. I don't know that I understood what it was, but it was the kind of thing that, why would you lie there in the cold? It's so cold. You know, it's the kind of thing that a child thinks about without even knowing why. And as we walked along in the mountain, somebody sat down for a minute, they were shot. If somebody looked around the wrong way, they were shot. If somebody fell, they were shot. No matter what you do, it was a good reason for the guards going along with us to shoot them. Nothing to eat. No place to go. You passed houses, and you were in that snow, and people just kept on driving off. Many of the death marches, not ours, they didn't care where you were going, like the one from Auschwitz, where people would walk for 48 and 50 kilometers in a day. They didn't care where they would take them, because most of the people, they just wanted them to be dead. Anyway, when we finally did reach Bergen-Belsen with my new mother, whom I don't remember what she looks like, or what her name was, but I also don't remember what my real mother looked like. When we got there, just the way my father predicted, we had to get undressed and leave all our belongings on the side, on piles, and go into the showers. I was holding on to the pictures. My father said they were important and to look at them. One of the soldiers saw that I was hiding something. Maybe it was a diamond, maybe it was money, maybe it was something of value. He pried open my hand. It was just pictures, garbage, dirt. Took them, tore them up, and threw them away. To him, that's all it was. To me, it would have been, does anybody in my family look like me? Do my children look like my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren? I have absolutely no idea what anybody in my family looked like. I also have no DNA to compare it to, nothing. It was just like it started from afresh. When we came out, and we were shivering because we were cold, because we were scared, because we were humiliated. Every woman got some sort of a garb, a blanket. And the blanket was for every four or five women. And we were going to sleep on those slabs that you had, except by the time we got there, they weren't left any. There were so many people coming in from all the other camps to Bergen-Belsen that there was no place to sleep. So we slept on the stone floor with hay and lice and fleas and rats running around, straw, and we were filthy, and this was filthy, and people couldn't get over to the bathroom, so they saw themselves all over. The smells were something you cannot describe and you cannot forget. And if people died there in the same area, everybody was there. Every day, the most important thing in Bergen-Belsen was food. All you thought about and all you felt was food. And once a day we would get the soup, which was made from for potatoes that were made from the frozen ground and turnips. And there was dirt around it, and the potatoes probably weren't peeled with the dirt. And if you looked at it and you smelled it, I wouldn't touch that if my life depended on it. Your life depended on it. And you may not touch it the first time, but afterwards you relished it. It was like ambrosia. It was the best thing around because it was the only thing. And you were so hungry, you would eat it. A lot of people died of dysentery, of eating this, and a lot of people died of not having enough food. Every day, hundreds of people died. And the same blankets that the women got to cover themselves, these are the kind of toilets. If you were lucky, you'd get 100 people to be sent in for 5 minutes to use the toilets. And if you weren't as lucky, there were pits outside, and you could go outside to relieve yourself. But the idea of falling into one of those pits was always so worrying. Can you imagine what would happen? Every place that you went, you were just in a toilet. In the barracks of the toilet, outside it was a toilet. And every place, okay, every day, I guess the blankets aren't there. The same blankets that people covered themselves, they would take a body, put the body into the blanket, and pull it out. And here you have another one. This is the children's barracks. And in front of it, you see people coming, pulling out the bodies. Sometimes you would just pull the body by the hands or the feet. But it was easier if a few people carried the blanket. And every place that you went in Bergen-Belsen was like open fields. There were bodies. It wasn't just one place. Every place that you went, there were bodies. The smell of those bodies, I know I bring up the smell to you all the time because this is something that you can just not get away from. These bodies were decomposing and they were there. And you know what? as a little girl, I walked past these bodies and it just didn't seem to bother me. It was a normal thing. You don't like going back past a garbage heap, but you do it, right? You just do it, and that's what happened. You get to think that everything that you do is normal. And they're naked, because if somebody, that's a good picture now, if somebody died, you would take their clothing so that you could clothe yourself with it. Maybe you would just take away some people. One day, I was very sick with typhus. Now, how do I know I had typhus? Somehow or other, I always said I had typhus, and then every once in a while, I would say, Rena, how do you know that? You were a little girl, you didn't know one sickness for another. Well, Barbara Sofer is writing a book about me, and she's a wonderful investigator, and she wrote to Sweden after the war, and they found my records that I had typhus, and I was in the hospital with a bad case of typhus with all my temperature and diphtheria, and it proved that what I had said was right. So now I have this, I don't think it's on over there, but I've got this chart, what my temperature was in every day, amazing. I can tell you many of the other things, you know, that I found. Not far away from the barracks that I was in, there were trees. And under the trees, it wasn't so windy. And typhus is the kind of disease that you can't see and you can't hear and everything is blurry and going on. Everybody had typhus. And if they didn't have typhus, I think, and everybody was going to die. And I don't know how I got to this place, but I was over there. And I knew that I would die. Why? Because today this one died, and yesterday that one died. And tomorrow they say she's not going to last very long. They were called Muslims, and they knew that you're going to die. So I knew that I would die. Didn't know just when. But you went over there, and there were living and dead people combined. Something happened that day that never happened before. They were soldiers, but they were wearing different uniforms, and they were acting very differently. And then people who never walked faster than a snail's pace were running. And people who never spoke above a whisper were shouting. And they were yelling something. I had no idea what it meant, but they could say, you're free, you're free. You can do whatever you want, you're free. What do I want to do? What does it mean to be free? What does it mean to other people? To me, I don't have a mother, I don't have a father, I don't have a home, I don't have food, I don't have anything. What does it mean to be free? Well, the British knew what it meant. They had a very hard job. The first thing they had to do was collect 10,000 bodies that you saw, 10,000 dead bodies, and bury them. And they buried them in big pits with bulldozers. You know how in the Jewish religion, probably in every religion, burial should be done with a little bit of respect and honor. Bulldozers you take and you shovel them in. 1,000 bodies, 2,000 bodies, another 1,000 bodies. They had to get rid of all these bodies. They had to get rid of the smells and the infectious diseases. So they made these big pits. There they are. And just shoveled in all the bodies into those pits. After they finished burying those people, they burned down all the barracks that the Jews lived in. They were so smelly and so filled with infectious diseases that there was no way to do anything about it. So they made a ceremony and they burned down. And the British took pictures of these things. These are not my pictures. These are pictures that the British took. They really documented it for the British. And then Americans with Eisenhower and Patton, they documented their camps. And so, but the barracks that the Germans were in, which were made out of bricks and cement, they were not burned. Just the barracks of the Jews, they were just, you just didn't want to keep them. After they burned the barracks and they buried the people, they took care of the people who were able to walk on their own. 14,000 people died after the war. 14,000 people died after the war. 2,000 died because the British gave them the wrong food. I'm not blaming the British, but if you haven't eaten for such a long time, to eat some rich food, if your stomach can't take it, or even if you eat good food but you're gobbling it down and you haven't had anything, 2,000 people died from whatever it was. 14,000 people died after the war because they were so things. And then after they fed those people, they took care of people like me who were very sick, but maybe with the proper help they could get better. And they took me by stretcher with a sheet to a makeshift hospital. And there were signs all over. I don't know if I have the pictures of it, maybe not. But they had a human laundry where they sprayed us against the typhus, and they bathed us, and they really tried to bring us back to health. And because I was one of the lucky ones, Sweden, that had been neutral and not at war with Germany, invited 6,000 children and refugees to come to Sweden. And I had the mazel of being one of them. And they took us by stretcher to a place called Lübeck, and there by boat to Malmö in Sweden. I don't know what happened to my quote mother, but when I got to Sweden, there was another woman who said she was my cousin and she was going to take care of me. And she even made me a sweater with white reindeers, you know, like the sweat. And, but I don't know what happened to her, but I was very sick. So they took me to a regular Swedish hospital, and I have all the records of that, the papers there, where, which prove, we wrote, Barbara wrote to Sweden, I've got all the records exactly when I came to Sweden, when I was in the first DP camp, when I was taken to the hospital, when I was taken to second DP camp. Now I have proof of everything that I'm telling you, so it helps me to say, you know what, you didn't make it up in your head, it really, really happened. Anyway, I was in this Swedish hospital. They really treated us very well. And there was a Christian family that came to visit me every day. They brought me a doll, and they brought me apples, and they brought me candy canes. It was Christmas time, red and white with cellophane that crackled. It was wonderful. And one day, this Christian man asked if I wanted to come and live with him. Well, I thought that was the best offer I ever had in my whole life. And they were so good to me, and they visited me, and they brought me all these different things that I never had. The people around me said that I was Jewish. What that meant, I had no idea. And I belonged in a place called Palestine. If I go to Palestine, I would meet my mother and my father and my brothers and all the children who are going to Palestine. Why did I say Palestine and not Israel? Just imagine if Israel had been born in 1945 instead of 1948. If it had been born in 1938. When the war, before the war, 10 years earlier before, instead of 48, 38, how many people could have survived? How many victims would have lived? How many survivors could have made a life for themselves? But there was no Israel. That's why it's so important for us to have people like you and our country and our government, whether we criticize it or not, whether we worry about it, we have a country, we have a government, and any Jew who wants to come here has a place to come. Nobody wanted us in those years, in the early 40s. And even after 45, we couldn't come here because of the British mandate. And all the countries had quotas to come.
How old were you when you came out of the camp?
I was probably nine and a half. As I said, I found my birth certificate in 1989, which is how many years ago? 25 years ago. That's when I was born again. That's not true. I was born in 1946 again, but I found my real birth certificate. So now I have two birth certificates, but I never changed the one that I got in Sweden, which I'll tell you about right now, because if you come into Kennedy 26 years later with a new, on your passport, a new birth certificate, they're going to keep you there for hours. You know, you can change your name, you can change different things about it, but you can't change your birthday. Anyway, but I found, and I'll tell you how. I did not go with a Christian family, and I went to a second DP camp. DP, Displaced Persons Camp, or Alien Camp. And there I met a new mother. Her name was Anna. I have pictures of Anna, too. That's me in Sweden. That's me here with a dog tag on it to prove who I am. And that's me after the war when I was going down. This is Lucia, who lives in Haifa, and Helena, who lives in Tel Aviv, and that's me in the center. Anyway, I met Anna. Anna's brother had gone to the United States before the war, and she had two children, Fanny, who was 9 and a half, and Sigmund, who was 15 and a half. And Anna got three sets of tickets for herself, her son, and daughter to come to America. Somebody had to sponsor you. So her brother sponsored the three of them. He sent her passports and visas and money and tickets and all the things that she needed. While they were waiting for the ship to take them to America, and I know the exact ship, as a matter of fact, now I know a lot of things, Fanny died. This little girl died. I told you a lot of people died after the war. Her death was my luck. Anna had tickets. Anna had all the documents that she needed. Her daughter died. She asked me to be her daughter. Anybody who wanted me, I certainly wanted them, and I thought that was the thing. I had a new mother, I had a new brother, I had a new birth, I had a birthday, not a new birthday. I never had any before. When it, the first documentation said that I was born in Polska, in Poland, in, and that I was 9 years old. I didn't even have a date. I didn't have any birthday. So now I have a birthday, and I was born in Germany. I told you I was born in Pietrzyca in Poland, but my passport says Germany, and that's what it still says, because that's what I got in 1946. I became Fanny, and I had a mother, and everything was fine, and we went on a ship, and you saw how everybody was good, and we laughed, and we ate, and in Sweden they really fattened us up, you know, like geese at your feet because you want them to be, and everybody pinched my cheeks to say, how could a child have been in a concentration camp, have, you know, look so well and all that. Really, we did. We really got much better, and we came to America. And I was on the ship, and I saw the Statue of Liberty, and there were all these big houses. And everybody said, all the people in America are rich and live in big houses. So in my way, the big house, like the Empire State Building or the Chrysler, those are big houses, right? So I thought maybe I'd live in one. I had no idea. I had no idea of anything. You don't realize I lived on a different kind of planet. Anyway, I didn't live in one of those houses. I was taken to Lindenhurst, Long Island, and Anna and her two children, Sigmund, who changed his name to Stanley, and they didn't like my name of Fanny, so it was changed to Francis, and we came to Lindenhurst, Long Island, and all the children started teaching me English, saying man, man, woman, woman, bottle, water. I started learning English. Nobody ever talked about the Holocaust. Nobody wanted to bring that up, and I certainly didn't want you to know that I was filthy, and I was with all these infectious diseases, and I had lice. I mean, now if you think of somebody lice, you think of somebody having these little things in your hair. That's nothing. Your hair gets black from tar, and you have it all over, every part of your body. And if you put on clothes, they get into your clothes, and you can never get rid of them. And that's why people have typhus, because every place that you go, everybody has lice. Matter of fact, the people who came into Israel when they finally came in, or Palestine, and they were taken to Atlit or Cyprus, they took them in for disinfection. And when people heard disinfection, they were terrified because they knew disinfection means showers, gas chambers. And of course, what the British really wanted in people was to disinfect their clothes or to get rid of the lice and fleas. Anyway, we came to America. Everything was fine. And that was in April. Somebody got me a baby carriage with a doll. So at the age of 10, I finally started learning. I learned a lot of different things. And we went up to the Catskill Mountains, to Fallsburg, New York, in a little bungalow colony. And there I went to day camp. By that time, I was speaking some English. And I learned to play jacks. People still play jacks. And I learned to ride a bicycle and go blueberry picking and hide and seek. And life was wonderful. And all the women gave me all the food. I had a bed, my own bed to sleep in. Everything was just perfect. But all of a sudden, Anna disappeared. It didn't bother me so much because all the other women were very good to me and I had all the food I wanted and I had a place and nobody was in shot. But a few days later, they came back with a big black car they call a hearse. Nobody explained to me what was happening. Anna died. Because so many people after the war, you know, you think that it was bad in the Holocaust, but after the Holocaust, it wasn't finished for so many people. Anna died. And she had been so weakened, she died. And they took us to the cemetery. Nobody explained to me. They thought I was so smart and so streetwise. And I saw this one big hole, maybe the size of a table like this. And they were lowering one casket, and I had to figure out what it was. And everybody was crying. Why would you cry for one person who died? Did you see all those hundreds or thousands of bodies? And nobody cried. I don't remember ever crying as a child. And certainly you didn't cry when you put somebody out. You just went ahead and took care of whatever you were doing at that time. One person and everybody's crying. It took me a while to understand that. It took me a while to understand a lot of things. We went back to sit Shiva. And after the Shiva, the family that brought Anna over had a problem. They brought over a child who was going to be taken care of by her mother. But now that she wasn't there, they didn't really want another mouth to feed. And as whatever I was still a child. I had to be clothed, I had to be schooled, I had to be taken care of in many different ways. One of the people in that family knew a family in Brooklyn, New York, who had no children. And I guess there was a lot of discussion back and forth. And that family invited me to come to Shabbat to spend time with them. And I went there, and they gave me a wonderful Shabbat. They gave me a doll and a ball and all the food. Food was very, very important. And a new dress. And it was time to go back. They said, would you like to stay and be our daughter? Well, you know I did. And starting at that point, I had a wonderful life. I was really an American princess. I had birthday parties. I had music lessons. I went to good schools. I didn't go to Yeshiva or Flatbush. rightfully so. I really wouldn't have fit in. And they gave me private tutoring. And by the time I finished college and I got my master's, I was very much... and now when I speak English, everybody thinks I was an American born because they spoke English. They came when they were 6 years old from Pinsker. So I got into this. We never talked about the Holocaust. In 1981, there was a gathering of Holocaust survivors here in Israel. Matter of fact, I think the Eliex were here at the time. And my family said, you know what? You're like an ostrich. You put your head in the sand, you make believe that nothing happened. I had a new family. My children had grandparents. We had everything. Why don't you go and see? Maybe somebody else survived. So we all came, and we went to Binyanei HaUma, and we put up little pieces of paper. You know how people put up things? Looking for my mother, my father, my brothers, my names, the different names that I had. Nobody recognized. We never existed. I don't understand how we never existed, because my mother apparently had a store, and I have to tell you about my mother. I'll tell it to you right now, because this was also something that Barbara found, that the woman who's writing this thing has been doing a lot of research, and you will not believe this. In 1930, my biological mother had a prenuptial agreement written in Polish, 3 pages of Polish, which is not a ketubah, it's not a Jewish document. 3 things, and she had an oak table, and she had an ottoman, and she had 2 sewing machines, and she had money, and she had jewelry, and all of this is listed, and in case the marriage breaks up, this is what she brought into the marriage, and this is what he did. Nobody heard, I mean, I don't think people heard of prenuptial agreements till the late 70s and 80s. My mother had one in 1930. Right? Amazing, right? And I always thought of her as being a poor Polish woman, but apparently nobody heard of her. When we were in Binyanei HaUma, nobody knew her name, nobody knew my name, nothing like that. So when we went home, this is my husband and me at our wedding. But before that, and this is the man who, before that, we wrote to Arlson, that first document that you have. It's okay if you don't see it. But Arlson is an international tracing bureau. If anybody is looking for anybody, that's the place. But now you can get it from Yad Vashem and from Washington and on the internet. But in 1981, you wrote to the Swedish Red Cross. Not to the Swedish, to the International Red Cross. Swedish Red Cross, we found other papers of mine. And they said to me, yes, I was born. My name was Fredja Lichtenstein. My mother's name, my father's name, how old they were, my grandparents, all the different things. Yes, I was in the ghetto. And then there's one thing that people say there's a mistake, because it says that I was in Częstochowa. Częstochowa was a man's camp. How could you have been there? So you know what? It's easier to say, okay. You know that I was there because I was a boy. I was a man at that time. They have a lot of information. In 1984, we made Aliyah. My husband and our children, my oldest daughter was married at that time. And I started volunteering in Yad Vashem. I started guiding. I started going with people to Poland. And in 1989, we went to Poland. I was terrified of going back, but it turned out to be quite a trip because I found my birth certificate, I found my brother's birth certificates, I found my parents' marriage license, I found the apartment, I found the factory, I found all the things that I thought maybe I didn't have the facts all straight. Everything went through. And I told you, I found the apartment with the mezuzah on the door. The Polish woman didn't even see it because it's been painted over many times. And I think it's very important when I'm asked to speak to a group like this, especially a group like this. I'm sure Hitler is looking up from wherever he's down there to see, look at this beautiful young group who have come to make sure that the Jewish people live on. I think that if I would have one request of you, is to marry other Jews. Hitler wanted to wipe out all the Jewish people. He succeeded by taking 6 million. But now, with the intermarriage and assimilation, he's getting a posthumous victory. If more and more people are intermarrying and assimilating, the Jewish people are dwindling. And you're the people who can make a difference. And I think we have to laugh as much as we can and love as much as we can and study as much and travel and take all your trips and do everything to make life as beautiful and as full. And thank God there are people like you who can make that reality. If anybody has any questions or any comments, I'd like very much to hear from you. Yes?
When did you take the name Rena?
I didn't take it. I didn't do anything.
What happened?
I didn't take it. My mother, I have to show you a picture of her. That leads me right into it. When I came, my name, Fredel, means joy. So in English, it's joy. In Hebrew, joy is Rena. So in 1946, I became Rena, which was a new Israeli name. Now it's a very common name. But in 1946, it was not. But I ought to show you a picture. You probably have it over there. Yeah, you probably have it. This is my family. It was a long time ago. So right now we have 4 children married, 22 grandchildren, and 17 great-grandchildren. But most of our children, our grandchildren, aren't married yet. So we're hoping to have many, many more. So I hope the next time you can invite me, you can invite more. But this is my mother, if you can find that picture. Her name was Leah Globe, Leah and Jacob Globe. And when you have that picture, good. And when she lived till she was 103 quarters. And we made a big party for her at the Great Synagogue, like a wedding, and she spoke at it. Matter of fact, one of the things she said is that when you get older, you become a philanthropist, because everybody gives, you know, a birthday present by giving a check to somebody, so maybe, yeah. But when she died, my oldest granddaughter wrote, when Leah gets to paradise, the first people she will meet will be Rena's biological parents, who will thank her for raising their daughter. So you have the people who gave birth to me, and the people who raised me. And very often the question is, which is more important, the genes, the heredity, or the environment? I don't know the answer, do you? Yes.
Not acknowledging death was not the way that most people...
I'm not sure I really thought about it that way, but the first way time that I really started talking about it was in 1981. When we came here, when we went back, my son was in the 8th grade in the Yeshiva Flatbush. All my children went there. And his teacher asked if anybody knew of a survivor who could come to speak to the class. With the classes, there were a few 8th grade grades, and they were meeting in the auditorium. And my son said, yes, his mother. And the teacher called me up, and she says, I don't quite understand, because I used to go with the kids on trips, and I used to serve in the lunchroom, and she never knew I was a survivor. Nobody in Brooklyn knew I was a survivor. I can tell you when my oldest daughter found out in some way. And she said, that's what David said, and he's a bright kid. And I said, no, he's right. I am a survivor, and we just went there. She said, would you come and talk about it? And I did. I was terrible. I cried at every second sentence. It was the first time that I said it, and my mother was sitting in the audience, and I didn't know how to react with her. When we were here in 1981, she was with us, and everybody was asking everybody, where were you during the war? What were you doing? When did you come to America? And so on and so forth. So I said I came to America in 1946, and then they asked my mother, and she said she came in 1906, and they said, you mean went back to Europe? She said, my daughter will explain it to you. She couldn't talk about it. Just as I found it hard to talk about, she found it harder. So that was one question. What was the other thing that I was going to tell you about?
At what point did you realize that people mourn death?
I guess as I got older, it just came off normally. But when you asked me before, when did I do this? I don't think I did anything. I think everything was happening to me. I think I was really too young and too inexperienced. It just happened. You accept it. And as you accept it, it's going on. I don't know if I really thought about the death. I don't know that I could have possibly lived with all these dead bodies if I knew anything. I don't know how people did. I just reread Night, Elie Wiesel's book, Night. I got the trilogy, Night, Dawn, and now it's called Day, just be called The Accident. And then I looked him up on the internet to find out how much is it biographical and how much is it fiction. And it's an amazing kind of thing if you compare it. I think his whole life, like The Accident or Dawn, everything is sort of based. He lives the Holocaust every day. I don't. I talk about it now a lot, and especially this week. But my grandson, who is wonderful, and he, my grandchildren are wonderful. But this particular grandson sees things. He's 14, and it was Asara Batevit, Kaddish Klali. Were you people like me who don't know where their parents were buried, when they were buried? It's the day that you light a candle, because we don't have a yahrzeit, and you don't have a grave to go to. So he came in, and the yahrzeit candles were finishing on this side in the dining room. But on this side, we were setting up for a pidyon haben, for our newest great-grandson. And he said, look at the difference. You're going from something that's dead and remembering that, and you're going to a pidyon haben, a boy who was born 30 days ago, and you're celebrating that. And that's what you have to do. I guess that's what we do with Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut in Israel also. We just go one to the other. So I really feel that living our life to the fullest the way I said to you is important. And I do. We travel. We do everything. I think every day has to have something good happen. Yes?
You speak with a lot of authority about things. I understand there was a little bit of a process of you figuring out what was your real birth name, what was your real... Can you talk a little bit about how you discovered for sure what your birth name is and who your birth parents are? And because that wasn't always clear to you.
It wasn't always clear to me, but when I found my birth certificate... How did I know it was... Oh, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked that. We have time? Yeah. Okay. What happened?
This is the last question.
Okay. What happened was it's what happened was I have a lot of stories like that of things that happened to me, and even today, like this prenuptial agreement that I'm telling you, or finding my records in Sweden, or finding my aunts and uncles, or finding that my father had to pay to live in the ghetto. I mean, I found all of these things I'm finding out right now. But what happened was that I hired a guide, and she took me to Pietrakov, and I was very rich at the time because. The whole day, we paid $20 for a taxi and a guide to take us from Warsaw, because it was 1989, it was before the revolution. And I brought gifts to bribe people. And the gifts were chocolate and coffee, leather belts, and some dollars. And with that, you could get a lot of different things. So she took me to the Hall of Records, and they wrote the names of the birthdays in ledgers, you know, big books. They didn't have computers and things like that, so we'd write it in by hand. So I said, I'm looking for a name, and I knew my name was Fredja Lichtenstein. And she said, give me your American passport, and I'll find your birth certificate. And well, the American passport, I can give it to you, but the name in my passport has nothing to do with the name I'm looking for that I was born with. My birthday is not what I have. My mother's name is not what I have. The place that I was born, nothing in my American passport matches my birth certificate. She thought I was a little crazy, and the guide explained to her that I really don't know exactly. So Fanny's birthday is February 15th, 1936. That's my birthday. I became Fanny. So I said, it's in February 15th, 1936. She looked all of 36, and it wasn't there. Then she went to 37, and it wasn't there. She went back to 35. She found it December 18th, 1935. It had my birthday, and it had my parents' name. It has how old they were. It has my grandparents' name. It has all these different things like that. So, you know, it was proof that it was me. And then I found my brother's names. And in Bergen-Belsen, everything was burned down. So there were no records of when we came in. I don't know how old I was when I came in. But there are lots of records when we went out. The British had records. The American Jewish Committee came in. Hatzalah had records. Then Sweden had records. So after 46, there are a lot of things about me. And then my name changes. Okay.
Thank you very much, Rita.